Okay, the next case we have on the docket for today is the United States versus Dockery. This is a appeal from the appellant. Are the parties ready? Okay, we'll hear first from the appellant.
Chief Judge Erdman, honorable members of the court, may it please the court. My name is Major Lauren Shore, and along with Lieutenant Colonel Jeff Palomino, we represent Master Sergeant Dockery. Racial stereotypes cannot be the foundation for an implied bias challenge, especially in a case where an African American is accused of raping a white woman. The Air Force Court should be reversed for two reasons. First, this was an improper use of race to remove a panel member under the guise of an implied bias challenge. Second, the removal was prejudicial to the appellant's substantial right to be tried in a court-martial free from all forms of purposeful racial discrimination in the selection of jurors.
Well, it wasn't an implied bias challenge, was it?
It was an
actual bias challenge.
Yes,
based on words out of her own mouth. The government, it appears, was trying to keep her on there until she shot off her mouth.
Well, it was a...
And then they challenged her on the basis of actual bias. And the judge, as happens more and more in these cases, fudged it and said, we'll just call it implied, and got rid of her that way. But, I mean, how does the fact that the government, within its rights, challenged her on the basis of actual bias, how does that somehow raise some constitutional dimension?
Well, Your Honor, the actual bias raised was not based on words she said. The question posed to her was, if you were in the appellant's shoes, would you want someone who looks like you on the panel? And she replied that she would, to be fair. Then her questioning went into, essentially, what is the composition of this panel? Aren't there supposed to be 12 members? There was an African-American who was already...
Counsel, wait a minute.
Yes,
you're saying that she was asked, would you want someone who looks like you on this panel?
The exact quote, Your Honor, was, would you want someone
like you on this jury?
On the jury, yes, Your Honor.
You now are injecting race where race was not placed there.
I apologize, Your Honor. Yes, that is correct. It was essentially, if you're sitting in appellant's shoes, would you want someone like you? She says, yes, I would like someone like me on the panel, and then questions the composition and whether or not there are going to be 12 members. On follow-up questioning from senior trial counsel, she specifically goes into, aren't there going to be 12 members? I'm confused as to the number of people that are supposed to be on the panel. The judge clears that up, and in his very brief analysis, two sentence, giving the exclusion granting the challenge, he simply says the actual bias was cleared up with my instructions on the number of the panel, but then just calls the rest of it implied bias. There are no follow-up questions, though, with regard to, does race have any impact for her? Is this a racial issue? Does she have racial biases? And if you look at the totality of the circumstances, just prior to that question, her answer in response to, does the fact that this relationship or this sexual encounter, whether it be consensual or not, the fact that it was between an African American and a white woman, does that bother you? And she says, no, absolutely not. I'm Hispanic and African American. That is absolutely, has nothing to do with anything, is actually the exact quote. So when you look at the totality of the circumstances, which the judge is supposed to do, when evaluating implied bias, what you have is a member whose concern isn't to do with race. She just is confused. That's why the government's challenge, actual or implied, and the eventual judge's grant raises the equal protection question. Because
if it has nothing to do with race, then what is the explanation for her comment, but for some reason an African-American person already got dismissed, so I would really think... And then she kind of wanders off. And so, I mean, that could be her saying, you know, the accused is an African-American, and we had two potential African-American members of the panel, and one has been gone, and it would be good to keep one more on it, or it could just have been a innocent comment, a confused comment. How are we to read that?
Well, Your Honor, again, looking at the totality of the circumstances, she is absolutely inarticulate. There is no question about that. When you look at the rest of the individual voir dire with her, there's a note on JA 45 which indicates she has a heavy foreign accent and speaks very fast. The remainder of her lengthy answers, or I guess the preceding answers that she gives to questions from both trial counsel and defense counsel, are sporadic. They jump around. They don't flow logically in some places. And I think that part of the question that comes out of her statement is that we're not really sure if she is hesitant here. But when you look at the rest of her statements, you can see that the hesitancy or the jumpiness, nervousness carries throughout. So it doesn't center just on this question alone. Moreover, if the trial counsel or the military judge had done what they needed to do in this case and followed up with questions with regard to that comment, we could have a more specific answer.
But didn't they follow up? The question was, are you concerned that he, referring to the other panel member who was African American, are you concerned that he was dismissed and that he's African American? And she responds, no, sir, no.
Exactly.
So didn't she clear up
the
ambiguity? And the ambiguity that was introduced by the question, where the question was, if you were in his shoes right now, referring to the accused's shoes. So she was being asked to respond to this from the perspective of the accused.
Absolutely.
Then when she's asked to give her perspective, she says concretely and clearly, no, sir, no.
Absolutely, Your Honor. She clears up that question, and so it still begs the question where we get to, where does the government counsel come up with this idea that she all of a sudden has this racial bias in favor of the appellant?
On that question, isn't it just as likely that, as opposed to a racial bias, isn't it possible or as possible that the member was as concerned about the appearance of fairness as our case law suggests we all should be?
Yes, Your Honor, absolutely. This court's case law, especially with regard to implied bias, is very clear that the public perception is what is most important, and it is appearance that carries the day. That is a direct quote from this court in Nash. Where trial counsel comes up with this is the question that we cannot answer. Moreover, the military judge fails to give any analysis or articulation with regard to his reasoning. As this court has asked for in the past, we expect military judges to give us something, to give you all something, to evaluate the record regarding whether, how, and with what nuance the military judge applied the principles embodied in the implied bias doctrine. That comes directly from Clay. There is nothing in the record here. The judge simply says there was no actual bias. I do find that there was implied bias on the part of Master Sergeant W from her utterance without precipitating factors.
Counsel?
Yes, Your Honor.
That part of the case, I think, is the clearer part of the case. The more confusing part of this case is if we were to assume that the removal was improper.
Yes, Your Honor.
The government made an actual a challenge for cause, and the military judge changed it to implied bias. And so now, if this court were to say the removal was erroneous, under implied bias, this court doesn't look to whether or not the appellant was prejudiced. It looks to see what the public perception is.
Yes, Your Honor.
So do we look at it through that lens, which is difficult to see? I mean, if you can follow the logic there, supposedly the military judge found that the public would find this to be detrimental to the reputation of the military justice system. And so now we're saying the basis for the removal was improper, and now we have to look at how the public would look at the decision, I guess, of us reversing the decision Is that the standard that we use, or do we actually go to actual bias and look at the makeup of the panel?
Your Honor, because the military judge used an implied bias basis, that's hard to say, because in this particular case, he didn't even invoke the legal standard. He just said the words implied bias, which this court has repeatedly found to be an error. And so absolutely, that was error itself. But then you look at the public perception. There's no way for us to know what the military judge found to be problematic about the public perception. And so if you look at it from the lens of what does this appear to the public, when just looking at the facts of this case, you have one member, one African-American member who was removed because he was a witness, because he was listed as a witness on the defense witness list. And then you have the only remaining member removed in a case where an African-American is charged with raping a white woman. It is hard to look at these facts as they played out and not find questionable public perception where the only remaining African-American member is removed based on nothing she said.
Okay, but getting back to the Chief Judge's question, what do we do with this? I've noticed that during your argument here, you've not uttered the word Batson, and yet that was something that you focused on in your brief. Have you given up on Batson?
No, Your Honor.
How do you get Batson if, in fact, this was a challenge for cause rather than a peremptory challenge? And let me ask you up front, have any federal circuits found Batson applies when it was a challenge for cause?
They have not, Your Honor.
And here, why would we want to extend it to that situation where this wasn't preserved on appeal?
Your Honor, to be clear, the appellant is not asserting that procedurally this case fits within Batson. It is the principles driving the Batson decision that apply and that mold or shape the argument in this case.
So are you arguing this is structural error, or are you coming up with some new precept that we should be applying here based on what you're arguing in front of us right now about how to look at these things?
Your Honor, the appellant argues that it is a violation of the Equal Protection Clause to remove this member without any actual or implied bias found in the words she spoke. Rather, the implied bias is based on the senior trial counsel's reading of what she said, which was, frankly, she dismissed that notion. What the senior trial counsel got up and argued, she dismissed wholeheartedly.
Can you point us to any cases that uses the same analogy of the Equal Protection Clause in this type of case?
No, Your Honor. This
what you're saying is, I think, you're arguing penumbras and emanations from Batson.
Your Honor.
Normally, when a member is erroneously excluded, any prejudice is problematic, because the member's gone. When a member who should have been excluded is kept on, then you got a far more compelling case for prejudice. He has no the accused has no constitutional right to a panel or a venner of any particular color.
Absolutely.
And yet you're making a constitutional argument.
The argument is the appellant had the right to have a panel that was not influenced by racial discrimination. That is what occurred in this case.
Who's right? It's a jump to go from saying that someone, they were wrong in how they understood her words, to saying that it was racial discrimination. I mean, that's the leap that you're asking us to make, and I don't think it's borne out by the record.
Well, Your Honor, and
I mean, you don't suggest that the government isn't entitled to a fair trial, too.
No, Your Honor, not in the least. It is the appearance of impropriety, that which we rest on the implied bias, the questions that we ask in implied bias that we have an issue with in this particular case.
Yeah, counsel, you seem to be arguing that the perception that was left after this ruling was worse than the perception the military judge might have been attempting to avoid.
Absolutely, Your Honor.
To begin with.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Because the member, when questioned, removed any doubt with regard to her racial leanings or otherwise. And so when the military judge then granted. And that is the biggest problem in this case, is the military judge granted without any explanation, none whatsoever. So there is, the only thing we are left to assume is that he granted based on trial counsel's statements. And that was improper. It had nothing to do with what the member said. It was read into her statement, frankly, based on nothing. There was nothing in the record that she said that implied she had a racial bias to favor the appellant in any way.
Now, under Batson, there's an opportunity to get the government story out of the record. Should there, in your scenario, be some requirement for defense counsel to say, Your Honor, you haven't articulated the basis for your excusal of this person, so then we, or the CCA, has the benefit of the explanation by the military judge?
Your Honor, this court's case laws and the CCA's case law clearly states that when you have an implied bias challenge, you must go through the analysis. It is not sufficient to...
It wasn't an implied bias challenge.
Absolutely, Your Honor, but he granted it under implied bias. And so when he dismissed the actual bias and came up sua sponte with this implied bias challenge, he failed to articulate any of his reasons that this court requires.
We will all agree with you that was bad. So where did that get you? That's not answering the question that we're asking you, which is, how does that help you?
Your Honor, when you look to the makeup...
And under the law.
Yes, Your Honor, absolutely. If a convening authority were to do this, or if this were to occur in a peremptory challenge, it would be reversible error. We can't allow a military judge or a trial counsel to assert the same bases that a convening authority or in a peremptory challenge that they wouldn't be allowed.
This didn't happen just in a vacuum. I mean, she made a statement, right, that could be read as problematic from the government's perspective. That's what he took away from the conversation. That was the basis for his challenge for cause.
Yes, Your Honor, but the military judge conducted no further analysis, so we have no way of knowing whether or not that was a proper takeaway from her statements. We don't know what the military judge based this on. I see my time has expired. Barring any further questions, I'll reserve the remainder for rebuttal.
Thank you, Counsel. We will now hear from the government.
Chief Judge Erdman, members of the court, may it please the court. I am Major Mary Ellen Payne, and along with Colonel Catherine Oler, we represent the United States in this case. The military judge did not err in granting the government's challenge of Master Sergeant LW for cause. The military judge's excusal of Master Sergeant LW did not violate the Equal Protection Clause and is entitled to deference, since the military judge was in the best position to evaluate Master Sergeant LW's demeanor and the context of her statements. Even if the military judge did err in granting the challenge, AFCA appropriately tested for prejudice and found none, because there is no evidence that appellant was actually tried by anything other than a fair and impartial panel.
So is the government viewing this as an actual bias or implied bias case?
Well, I think that the argument can be made that she demonstrated both actual and implied bias, Your Honor, but I think if we look at...
If it's actual, it's not implied.
Well, that would be true, Your Honor.
Yeah.
But I think that the point here is, I think that when the military judge is reviewing what happens, we have to look at whether or not he would have been correct under actual bias and whether or not he would have been correct under implied bias as well, because he did issue the ruling and base it on implied bias. So I think that is what this court would be reviewing in this particular case. But the first thing that I would like to talk about is the concept of forfeiture, because appellant in this case forfeited any ability or the ability to bring an equal protection issue before this court. So in that case, when we're looking at any equal protection argument, we should be looking at it from the context of plain error. It is well settled in federal court just all of them that have addressed the issue, and that means just about all of them in general, have said that failure to raise an equal protection claim under Batson, that forfeits the issue absent plain error. And the three military service courts as well that have addressed this issue have also applied forfeiture. And here there can't be any doubt that the trial defense counsel did not raise the issue of equal protection. He never said the words equal protection. He never said the words Batson. He never said that the government was engaging in purposeful.
Do we have to get into equal protection to decide this case, regardless of which way we decide it?
No, Your Honor. This
okay,
court
could. Okay, well then let's.
We will just talk about the propriety. Okay, Your Honor, we'll just talk about the propriety of the challenge that the military judge granted under implied bias. But I think the ramifications of that, Your Honor, is that if we're not looking in equal protection context, we're not talking about structural error, and we should be looking at whether or not there is prejudice.
Counsel, the trial counsel, in his argument to the military judge, stated she, referring to the member, expressed basically the fact that she kind of felt like she needed to protect the accused or kind of battle for him because we'd already excused one black member. It seems to indicate that she had a bias in his favor along racial lines. Now, what in her statement gives support to that rather sweeping statement?
Well, I think it was just the context in which her statement came up. She was asked, would you want a person like you on this particular panel? And she brought up...
If you were in his shoes.
Right, yes, Your Honor. If you
That's
were.
Very important, is it not? That she was asked specifically, if you were in his shoes, would you want someone like you?
That is true, but again...
So getting back to the Chief Judge's answer.
So getting back to the answer, I think that it could possibly raise the specter of favoritism. And I want to make an analogy that takes this out of the context of race. In the Air Force, obviously, we have a lot of pilots. So imagine we have a
Okay,
pilot
but you're talking about the specter. When she then is explicitly asked, if race is an issue there, she says, no, sir, no. And then trial counsel tries to turn around and say, well, what she initially said, she let it slip out. Now she's trying to backtrack. It's clear from the record that this E8 is not the most fluent person in speaking, but she says, no, sir, no, very clearly. So why should we simply look at the specter rather than her direct words?
Well, Your Honor, I respectfully disagree with how unequivocal she was about that, because immediately after she says, no, sir, no, she says, well, I don't know, and then brings up the issue of, well, are there 11 people on the panel? Are there 12 people? And if you look at the entire context of her answer, she's saying, I think I will be fair. She says, I think I will be fair. She says that repeated times. And I think the importance here is when we're talking about context and we're talking about demeanor, the military judge really is the person who's in the best position to make that call and to interpret what she is saying. And for that reason, the military judge is entitled to a certain level of deference. Yes, the government absolutely agrees that his ruling on the record could have been and should have been more expansive than it was. But this court has never said that the military judge is entitled to no deference if he doesn't put his analysis.
But counsel, but on implied bias, if he doesn't really put anything on the record to support his ruling, doesn't he get less deference? Haven't we said that?
Yes.
Specifically in the implied bias theory.
And I agree with that, Your Honor. He would be entitled to less deference, but he wouldn't be entitled to no deference. And this
agreed.
This court has repeatedly said that when there are issues of interpreting demeanor or any ambiguity in what the member said, that's where the military judge is entitled to deference. And if I can read the scene.
How do we know that that's what he was looking at? He didn't say.
Well, certainly we do have to read a little bit of it into what his final answer came out.
I have a cold record. I wasn't there.
No, I agree, Your Honor. But again, it's a cold record. And so that's why the military judge is entitled to deference. And if I can.
Some deference.
And if I can read what the CMA has said previously in United States v. Smart, when there is ambiguity in the answers of the member, we should give great weight to the evaluation of those answers by the military judge who observed the member's demeanor during voir dire.
If he explains it. I mean, we have had an entire line of cases since the case you just cited.
Agreed. And so perhaps less deference here, but on issues of context, the military judge and demeanor, the military judge still is entitled to deference. And especially, that's especially true in this case where there were a lot of hesitations, there was a lot of stopping and starting as to Master Sergeant LW's answers that she was given. And so I do believe that deference is important here. And also I would like to talk about inferences. Trial counsel and military judges, very few members are going to come out and specifically say, I'm biased against the accused, or I'm biased against the government. The parties are in the position where they have to rely on inferences in this case. And what happened here is that that's what happened. Trial counsel thought, well, based on this, the member is going to be biased. Or
is that a reasonable inference, counsel, that just because a black person's on the panel that they're going to be somehow sympathetic to the black accused?
Well, now that's
Hispanic accused or whatever?
Your Honor, that would be absolutely prohibited under Batson. You can't.
Well, this isn't a Batson case. This isn't a Batson case.
No, I know. And, Your Honor, it would be absolutely improper to say merely because of someone's race that they're going to prefer an accused. But that's not what happened here. He based it on what
you
she
think
said.
You think his inference from those few words she said suggests all of what he said, this anti-government bias, that somehow she's going to sympathize with the accused. You think you can infer all of that from what her comment was?
Well, Your Honor, if you unpack her statements, her response, she says, well, for some reason, another African-American person already got dismissed.
Which was an accurate statement because she didn't know why and wouldn't be told why.
Exactly.
That would be something you would wonder about, I think.
Well, sure, but Your Honor, it says that that's in the forefront of her mind when she's asked whether or not she wants, if she was in the accused's shoes, whether or not she would want someone like you on the panel. That's sort of the first thing that comes out, in contrast to most of the other members.
And that question that asks, would you like someone like you on the panel, she is a Hispanic African-American woman. And so they're asking her whether a female of that race should be on the panel. So they're injecting race into this. That's what that question was directed at.
Your Honor, that is not normally my interpretation of what's being asked. When that question is pretty commonly asked during voir dire, and my interpretation of it always is, do you want someone of your temperament to be on the panel, not someone of your
specific
identity?
You didn't ask that. I mean, we're talking about a layperson on a jury. They had just asked her a question about biracial marriages. So, I mean, race was injected into this well before she responded. And the CCA's determination that she spontaneously brought up race,
correct,
I think is a little flimsy.
Well, again, it was a different question, and they had moved on topics, Your Honor. But I do believe, Your Honor, that it was an inference that could fairly be drawn. Perhaps it wasn't the only inference, but it was a fair inference that could be drawn. And what the courts have said is that...
Let me ask you this. Let's assume there are two perceptions at play here. One from the, let's say, from the military judge's perspective, that he may not have wanted the perception to lie that the military judge had allowed race to be injected into the proceedings. And so he was going to sui sponte, remove the member under an implied bias ruling, right? Let's say that's one perception.
Correct.
Now let's say, for sake of argument, that the other perception is that one in the public might have is that having removed two of the African-American members from the panel, in a case where you have an African-American accused, might have, you know, there's another perception that the public might have there, that maybe the process isn't fair. Now, if you have these two competing perceptions, for the sake of argument, because you may not agree with me on what my two perceptions are, but let's say, for the sake of argument, that you have these two competing perceptions. Which one are we to be most concerned with?
Well, Your Honor, I think everything has to be looked at the perspective from a what this court has already always said when we're looking at issues of implied bias. You have to look at a reasonable, disinterested member of the public who is familiar with the military justice system and knows the facts of what's going on.
That doesn't answer Judge Sparks's question. Which of the two perceptions that he outlined to you should we be most concerned with?
Well, I think that they're both a concern, Your Honor, and I think that you have to weigh it based on the individual case and the individual facts of the case. I mean, historically, yes, going back to Batson, there's this incredible line of cases that talks about eradicating the perception of intentional racial discrimination from the panel and appearances. But I do feel you need to look at the reasonable, disinterested member of the public who knows all the facts, because I believe that that particular person would not believe that there was any purposeful racial discrimination going on in this case. And so while it is an absolutely valid and important concern, again...
Well, the trial counsel seemed to think that there was. He thought that maybe the member was of a discriminatory or at least a biased mind, that this member had an animus against the government based on this statement. So,
well, in that case, if we're talking about there's a chance that someone is going to engage in purposeful racial discrimination, then that concern probably would be greater than saying, well, a reasonable disinterested person here is not going to find that there is racial discrimination.
But we don't know because the military judge didn't tell us, right?
That is true, but what the Supreme Court has said is, like, when you're looking at two possible ways to weigh the evidence, two possible ways of interpreting what was said, the military judge's choice between the two of those cannot be clearly erroneous here. And so, again, I think that is where he is entitled to discretion.
Well, wait a minute, counsel. Cannot be clearly erroneous. He's faced with a challenge. She said this. And he's faced with a challenge based on actual bias on which he has to rule. And what he says is, well, I instructed her on how many members are needed in this court-martial, and as far as I'm concerned, that cleared that up, but I find implied bias. He pulled it out of the air, sua sponte, with no explanation whatsoever. So now what are we supposed to do?
Well, Your Honor, I do think that implicit in his ruling is...
This is just more of the same thing of treating implied bias, which is a different thing, as a sort of junior version of actual bias that you can paper cracks over with when you don't really want to do actual.
And I know you really don't like that.
That's where we are.
I know that's one of your pet peeves.
Yes. But I'm asking you... Here we are. Now, what do we do with this?
Well, how about we go and we talk about the concept of prejudice? I believe that it was not error. I believe that the military judge, even though you may be giving him less deference, he obviously made a choice of the facts in this case, that he was going to interpret her statement a certain way, or he was going to say that the public might interpret her statement a certain way. And because he chose between two permissible views of the evidence, he deserves deference for that particular decision. So, again, I do not believe that it's error, but I have limited time going, and I would like to address, well, what do we do if it was error? What do we do about the issue of prejudice? And I think that the courts that have addressed this, the circuit courts, talk about the improper excusal of a member for cause who should not have been excused. None of those circuits treat this as structural error.
But did any of those courts do it on the basis of implied bias? Because that's what makes this case different. The military judge's interjection of that basis, which takes away the challenge for cause and puts us clearly into a implied bias world, and once we're there, how do we bail out of it, which is what the government wants us to do, and go back to an actual bias prejudicial analysis?
Well, Your Honor, I think those cases, the circuit cases that have addressed the issue, I don't know if they parse out very clearly the difference between implied and actual bias. It wasn't apparent just from reading the decisions how how the person specifically was challenged for cause. But I think whenever we're testing for prejudice, I mean, we always go back in this case. We look at Article 59A, was there material prejudice to a substantial right? And I just don't believe that appellant can point to any of his material rights that were prejudiced in this case. Now, we talk a lot about, well the issue of perception here, but when we're talking about an equal protection, if we talk about the types of things that normally would cause a ruling to be overturned, it's not enough just to show, you know, well, things, you know, may look bad. I mean, usually we're talking about there actually having to be a showing of purposeful racial discrimination.
But it is.
Let's just say, take the reason away. What's the ordinary test if implied bias was used improperly?
If implied bias was, well, there have been.
The ordinary judge made an error. They granted it. They found implied bias, and they shouldn't have. What do we normally do?
Well, this court has had very few cases where it's actually addressed that, and most of the cases were capital cases, which would be completely different. I mean, if it's a capital case, the sentence at least has to be overturned. Now, in Quintanilla, which is one of the cases cited in our brief, Your Honor, it was a capital case, and the member was improperly removed. It wasn't 100% clear whether it was for actual or implied bias, as I recall, why that particular member was removed. But in Quintanilla, the court says, this court says we have to overturn the sentence in this case, but we do not overturn the findings in this case. And as a matter of fact, the CCA had overturned the findings, and this court reversed and said, no, that was incorrect, because we look at whether or not the appellant actually received a trial by a fair and impartial panel. And so that would be the same standard that I encourage this court to use in this particular case if you do find error. Was appellant in this case tried by a fair and impartial court? And all the evidence suggests that he absolutely was. The appellant on appeal has never made an argument that he received a trial by, or the members that actually sat, that they were not fair and impartial, and because the appellant simply cannot point to any error that actually prejudiced him. He didn't lose any of his peremptory challenges. Sometimes that's a ground for prejudice, but that didn't happen in this particular case.
Counsel, what happens if you have a situation where, let's say hypothetically, the military judge removes a member from the panel for no reason, doesn't announce anything on the record? Counsel are looking at each other wondering why. And there's no reason at all. And later on appeal, the accused comes to us and says, hey, wait a minute. We think the military judge erred because he used no basis. Don't you have to have some basis for removing a panel member? Right? But what if the military judge gives no basis? Clearly that would be erroneous, would it not?
I would agree with that. And, Your Honor, I see that my time is up. May I?
Please respond.
Yeah, well, what happens in that case later on? Is it your view that, hey, look, once again, we look to whether or not the remaining members still gave them a fair trial?
I would absolutely agree with that, Your Honor, because again, even if there was an error in this improper removal of the panel member, there was no reason given at all, and we all agree that it's error. I mean, we're looking at what substantial right of the actual member or of the appellant in that particular case.
We're affected.
We're affected, and he... You know, he's not entitled to any specific panel. I mean, this court and even the Supreme Court has been very clear. You're not entitled to any particular panel or racial makeup. So we look at the members that actually sat on the panel. Ross v. Oklahoma is the case that was cited in the AFCA opinion, and that the Supreme Court's very clear on that. You look at the members who were actually on the panel. And, Your Honor, may I briefly conclude?
Briefly.
There was no equal protection violation in this case, and the military judge did not err in granting the challenge for cause to Master Sergeant L.W. Appellant suffered no prejudice as he was tried by a fair and impartial panel as required by regulation and by the Sixth Amendment. Therefore, we respectfully ask this court to affirm the findings and the sentence.
Thank you, Counsel. We'll now hear rebuttal from the appellant.
Picking up with the what if there's no reason at all, Your Honor. What if the judge said I had chicken for lunch, and therefore I'm excusing this member? There's no analysis. And if this court allows that to continue, or that essentially, if we look at this and say that this is okay, what is to limit military judges from doing it from here forward? If the court wants a limiting principle, wants to limit this particular case to the facts of these cases, race is where we land on that one. The court does not need to be concerned about opening the floodgates and saying this is going to allow reversals in all of these cases because it's some sort of new structural error. This case is limited by the military judge's error in failing to articulate anything on the record and allowing the race to be interjected in the system. Additionally, going back to your question on public perception, the military judge must be concerned about the public perception from everyone that is looking in on the court, knowing all the facts of this case. The facts of this case, as this court has aptly pointed out throughout this oral argument, there is no reason why the trial counsel pulled or extrapolated this from what the member said. Race was injected into these proceedings for no reason. Finally, when you look to prejudice, it is frankly impossible in a situation like this for an appellant to show prejudice. That is why the alleged prejudice. Your Honor, the prejudice we allege is that there was a violation of his right to a jury free from racial discrimination, as the government conceded that is a right that he has and he is entitled to. While that prejudice may not necessarily tie to the findings, if we allow it, it is to allow the government to end run around Batson in challenges for cause. There is no longer a limitation on what the government can do.
Are you alleging that the trial counsel and the military judge in this case are racially prejudiced? Is that what you're alleging?
It
sounds like it.
The record speaks for itself, Your Honor. There was nothing that the member said that indicated a racial bias. The senior trial counsel stood up and said, because she stated she was African American and Hispanic, she now has a bias in favor of
the
appellant.
That's not what he said. You're right. The record speaks for itself, but I think you're misrepresenting what it said.
And I apologize if we have a different understanding of the record, Your Honor. But we must require race-neutral reasons to challenge these members, and there was nothing that we can extrapolate from the record based on the military judge's granting of this challenge under an implied bias standard as to what the race-neutral reason for this granting was.
Well, now, wait a minute. If you have a challenge for cause on the basis that the member is racially biased, you cannot have a race-neutral reason.
Absolutely, Your Honor. I see my time's expired. May I address
please,
the question?
Please respond.
Your Honor, if a member expresses a specific, or their actions or words express that bias.
I'm not saying that's this case.
Exactly, Your Honor.
But,
that
but
is a legitimate
the categorical
reason.
Statement simply wrong.
Absolutely. And so to differentiate those, where a member expresses a bias, that is absolutely permissible. Whereas this case, it was the senior trial counsel who read that bias in, and the member did not use those words, it is not permissible.
Do we have to go to Batson for you to prevail?
No, Your Honor.
Explain that.
Your Honor, it is the principles that drive Batson. So it's not the ultimate conclusion in Batson. The case law goes back
so
to
So it's what Batson stands for, but not Batson.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you.
No, Your Honor, it's based on the implied bias test this court has laid out in its prior case law, requiring the military judge to give some analysis. Well, Your Honor, it's the equal protection question that's established in Batson. So it's the driving principles of Batson, but it's not the ultimate conclusion of Batson.
Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
The court thanks Counsel for both parties. The case is now submitted, and the court will be in recess until 9:30 tomorrow morning.
Until 9:30 tomorrow morning.